Find them before they have the heart attack, not after. So demonstrating heart disease reversal, we happened to have four people over the couple of years when we were shooting the movie who had significant scores. And what should happen by orthodox medicine or the Heinz-Nixdorf recall study or, is they should just keep going up. Progressive disease, like type 2 diabetes, it's chronic, progressive, it'll keep getting worse. However, the four people we happen to have who took the multiple measures.
Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. We're supported by the Irish Heart Disease Awareness Charity, which advocates a simple CT scan to reveal your CAC score. So know your score and take action to prevent that premature heart attack. Everything you need to know will be right here.
Now, I'm going to introduce Ivor, but he introduced himself and he tells us all about the Irish Heart Disease Awareness. I won't talk about that, but what I want to highlight here for any of you here in the audience that would like to bring good health into old age, Ivor has written a book, Eat Rich, Live Long, and it's a lovely book. And he's going to talk about heart disease today, but he's also interested in the prevention of a whole lot of other chronic diseases that are really prevalent in society at the moment. And he's particularly interested in answering questions, and he's very good at answering very difficult questions. So feel free to ask him that. So without any further ado, can I ask you to give him a very warm capital welcome?
Thanks a lot, Catherine, for those kind words. So, and to all the team with yourself who organized this, I'm delighted to be here on behalf of Irish Heart Disease Awareness. So my talk, hopefully it's not too complicated. I've tried to pitch it at the right level. Very briefly, I'm a biochemical engineer, UCD 1990, and I've worked for around 30 years in complex problem solving, so leading teams across the world in complex problem solving. And I actually, around 7 years ago, got into the health sphere. So I'll touch on my story later. But first, a few words from my sponsor, David Bobbitt, the Irish entrepreneur. So he owns and runs one of Ireland's largest corporations. And he's put $5 million of his own money into this effort, of which this is part. So I'll just give a few words from him, and you'll hopefully see his passion for this endeavor.
And it, you know, this has put a huge amount of my time and resources, but if I can save one life, if I can help many people have the same opportunity as I had, why should somebody like myself have this opportunity that not given to others? And that's driven me every day, every single day.
So that was at a talk and a conference we gave in DCU in 2016, but he is seriously passionate about this, and hopefully that came across there. I'm going to tell you a story because it's a very illuminating one. So I mentioned already who he is. He was 52 years old, around 7 or 8 years ago, jogging 4 times a week, described by his doctors as bulletproof, top 10% fitness for his age. So a super slim, super fit guy, very focused on health. What happened was he got loads of tests, executive medicals, top of the range stuff, as you can imagine. All the bloods were good, treadmill, stress test, ECGs, top 10% for his age. He happened to get a calcium scan, which I'll be talking about, in the States by coincidence, randomly. He was 906 score, worst 1% for heart disease extent for his age, 50 to 70% chance of a heart attack or death in the next 10 years. So everything changed. CAC scan supersedes all blood work, all tests, easily. He then found out with an angio he had 3 blocked arteries, very extensive multivessel disease, so huge damage inside. But he didn't get surgery because he was asymptomatic. And it's a bit complex, but if you have no symptoms and you've got collateral networks, you may not need surgery at all. You need medications and lifestyle and nutrition changes. So he went for 6 months and he researched the whole area, didn't leave any stones uncovered. He found out a couple of months later he was type 2 diabetic, undiagnosed, and he was a screaming diabetic. So your blood glucose level should not go above 5.6, 5.8 after a meal, maybe 6.2. He was going up to 20 and 25. None of his blood tests showed this. I'll tell you about that in a while. And he found out that nutrition is the primary root cause of the cardiac epidemic and many other chronic diseases. So he learned a lot of what I know now. He went and he took action and he resolved his disease process. And he basically stopped the progression of this progressive disease, brought it down to so low a rate of progression, he's essentially pretty much as safe as anyone now. So he did, learned how to do that. He founded IHDA. He spent $2 million to get the Widowmaker movie made about this. We'll give you a free copy afterwards. Total philanthropy, no commercial interest whatsoever. Undiagnosed diabetes type 2 is going to come up repeatedly, so you're going to see this stamp, because that's what most of this actually is about. So what's my career now? Well, I work on behalf of IHDA. David found me around 5 years ago, and I spread the message. We have a new website, all revamped with short videos, a lot of material there on the calcification scan, beyond what I tell you today. I've spoken keynote addresses at the British Association for Cardiovascular Prevention in the UK. There's the president, Scott Murray, who's actually a good friend of mine now. And I've debated doctors of medicine, professors of medicine and nutrition in the National Institute of Preventive Cardiology Conference. So although I'm mostly straight to nutritional conferences and the people, I kind of get into the medical sphere too. And that's important because what we have to say is really required if we're going to stem the tide of the epidemics. The book I have out with Dr. Gerber in the US, we released a couple of years ago, covers everything. And I go around to conferences around the world. Here's me in Houston, but I've been in Israel, Switzerland, you know, England, all over the US, West, East Coast, and Central US. So that's an important part of getting the message out, because the videos go on YouTube, so they reach much bigger audiences. So I'm going to look now at health span. So whatever about lifespan, how long you actually live, if you spend your last 20 years in very poor health, it's not so great. So I think of health span. And the people who make all the right choices and are lucky with genetics can get up to their 80s with very good health, okay? The people who make very bad choices or are genetically unlucky, but it's mostly the choices you make on average, they can be actually very sick in their 60s. So there's a huge amount of time to play for there. And if you're like me, you bust your ass the first part of your life hoping to have enough money to enjoy a retirement, right? But there's a lot to play for out here. You've got, you know, grandchildren growing up, being part of their development, socializing, sports. That's a golden period, and that's what you're playing for when you take measures to keep and keep your health intact and your vitality. This is the biggest thing that gets in the way, pretty much heart disease. Biggest killer in the world, kills 5 times more women than breast cancer, believe it or not, and it's the big one. And the biggest challenge that drives this disease is atherosclerosis. It's kind of a big word. And atherosclerosis is the progressive disease that destroys your arteries, all your pipes, right, for your blood. So I'm going to bring you through it here now and just explain what it is, not too complicated. So basically, when you get a young person who's healthy, the inner wall of all their pipes, right, in here, is smooth and healthy tissue. Most average middle-aged office workers will have many atheroma or atheromatous plaque, and they're like pustules or boils on the inner wall of the pipe, okay? And they can rupture. So over time, as you continue to drive this progressive disease, they get bigger and more complex, and calcium is brought in by your body to try and strengthen them, almost like encapsulate them in bone. So that's your body trying to stabilize these in case they blow, right? So you get more and more of them. Over time though, if you keep driving the process, eventually you'll get breakouts, thrombus, and it'll be asymptomatic. Your doctor won't know, you won't know, you think you're fine. But at some point you'll get the big one, block a main vessel to the heart with a big burst of a plaque, and then you go down with a heart attack. And you know, 30-40% of first heart attacks are fatal, so it's very serious business. But imagine you could go back 10 or 20 years, like David Bobbitt effectively did, and you could go back and actually get a scan and look and find out how much calcium is there and therefore how much disease you have. Then you could research, put in the fixes, and fix the problem. Because it's a progressive disease, and if you stop what's driving it, it will calm down and stop. And if you do that, and we know this now, you will get stabilization. And the calcium won't disappear. It'll stay like a scar, just a kind of, the honor of battle. But if you stop it progressing, these are safe, and your risk will plummet compared to letting it continue to progress. And you actually will avoid that premature heart attack. Who knows, 10 or 20 years you might put it out. Maybe you'll put it out indefinitely. Huge difference if you do this. So coronary artery calcification and the CAC score, this is the magic that allows you to find out what's really going on inside and whether you need to take big action. To save the most at risk, you must first identify them. So in complex engineering, we say if you don't measure it, it don't get fixed. If you don't measure it, you can't understand it. So we were stunned when we discovered about this scan that they're not using it hardly, the thing that actually tells you what's going on. So if you take an eye and look at the absurdity of some of the medical business, if a woman is worried about cancer or there's a concern of potential cancer, say breast cancer, there's a simple technology, few minutes, and you scan and look for any worrying mass or any tumor, or you want to get it early. And if there is disease presence and you find something, of course you get treatment, whether it's surgery, whether it's medications, radiotherapy, but you get it early because you find out before it becomes really serious. You don't wait for the cancer to progress to stage 4 and then go in and find it. This makes sense. In heart disease, sadly, it's very different. So if a man or a woman is worried about having a heart attack, which could kill them in 40% of cases, and what happens is they actually ask you a few questions. So, and maybe you're familiar with this. They don't do a scan, they ask a few questions, cholesterol, HDL, blood pressure, and then they take a guess. And that's literally what it is. There's a few questions, some statistics, and they take a guess. They guess whether you have heart disease or not, right? And then they guess, well, if you look like you have a high chance of having it, we'll give you meds for what you might have. Right? But they don't know if you have or not. And if you get a low score in the guesswork, then maybe you don't get meds, but you could still have huge disease, but you don't get the medications to help you. So hopefully you can see how kind of weird this is. Of course, what should happen is, like with cancer, you go in and you scan the heart with a calcium scan and you see the disease in the vessels and how much there is. Then, if you've got a high score with lots of disease, you're a super high-risk patient, you will appropriately get the meds to help prevent the heart attack. You will get surgery to save your life if you need it. And we know many of these guys who got a high scan who have gone straight into quintuple bypass, and the day before they were told they have no issue, right? And of course, diet and lifestyle is important. I'm going to talk about that bit later. A lot of people are interested in what's the best diet and lifestyle. But you get action taken based on your risk. And that's the way it should be. So here's the scan. It takes 5 minutes. It's around $300 or €300 in Ireland, sometimes covered. And you can see there my buddy, Dr. Jeff Gerber. He's 56 in this scan and he has zero calcium. There's nothing in the middle of his heart, in his heart's arteries. He's got a zero score, which they actually call a 15-year warranty, because your death rate is so low with a zero calcium score that it's called a 15-year warranty if you get a zero at middle age. Here's a very different person, anonymous. They've got a score up in the hundreds. See all the calcium in the main coronary arteries, right? That's a super high-risk patient. But neither of these guys knew the day before they got the scan where they were, but they knew the day after. The scan centres, there's 8 or 10 in Ireland, and you'll get them on the IHDA website. That's good. X-ray risk, sometimes you will hear a very devious thing from people. An argument against the scan that, oh, there's radiation. It's a 1 in 20,000 lifetime increased theoretical risk for the 1 millisievert radiation, which to an engineer is zero. And imagine what you can do with the information, right, that you get from it. So that's a distraction, an obfuscation, so we don't worry about that. And all presidents in the US and all astronauts must have a calcium scan before they take office or go into space. So that'll give you the answer immediately, right? They get it because they're important and they know that this is the only way to find out. So IHDA is not pushing anything that's not in the guidelines. The new 2018 guidelines out of the US cardiology community are published, and they highly recommend the scan for middle risk, middle aged people to find out what's actually going on. So there's a 1 minute video there from a senior doctor on Medscape on our homepage. So again, we're only trying to get awareness out of what's already in the guidelines, but people don't know about. I'll show you a few numbers. I don't want to go too heavy on this, but here is the heart attack rate in 10 years in a very good study. But there are hundreds of human studies. They all say the same thing, right? I'll only show one. And no matter what age range you're in, if you get a zero calcium, like my buddy Dr. Gerber, you have very low risk. It's never zero. You could have an electrical problem. You could have a single big soft plaque. It's not zero, but with a zero score, it's very low. With a medium score, 1 to 100, the risk is maybe 5 times as high that you'll have a heart attack in the next 10 years. Okay, 5 times, that's a big multiplier. And if you get a high score like David, it's around 20 times higher chance. So that's 2,000% higher. It's huge. If you have bad cholesterol or blood pressure, it might be 1.5 times higher risk. This is 20x. Just to stress that a 50-year-old with a very high score, and they are walking around, all around us, but no one knows, unless you scan them, has around 20 times the risk of a 70 or 80-year-old who gets a zero. Right? So it's even independent of age. It beats age, which is the biggest risk factor. So it's quite stunning. Now, there are very few zeros in this age bracket. Most people have calcium when you get older in the Western world. David Bobbitt got that high score at 52, and he pretty much went crazy. And that's why he's invested $5 million in this and set up the charity. So can we intervene to slow or stop progression? Because that's the million-dollar question. You find out you've got big disease. Well, A, you can get drug treatment, which reduces heart attacks and stabilizes these plaques. B, you could get emergency operation, which would save your life. So that's all a given. But C, could you actually really do stuff to stop progression? So let's talk about that. The key is to slow the progression of the disease, just like cancer or anything. If you slow cancer right down, technically you don't need to get rid of it. You need to slow it enough that you die of old age from some other reason. So this study in humans, they got people who are very high score, obviously very high risk. The day they got the scan, they got a huge score. So they're massive risk, like I showed you. And the ones they tracked that increased their score per year when they scanned them yearly by more than 15%, so say 600 to 750 the year after to 900, which is very common if you do nothing. That's the default. They had a 50% heart attack rate in that group. That's 1 in 2, right? Double barrel shotgun, not even Russian roulette. However, the people in the study with the same high score at same notional risk, but who managed to slow the progression to less than 15% per year. So it's just high progression down to slow. You don't need to stop it. Do you think they had a lower heart attack rate in the following 5 or 6 years?
Yes.
What do you think? Yes. 5 times less?
Yes.
17 times less. So their risk actually became the default risk for someone who had a zero score in the first place. Pretty close. Maybe a zero would be 2.2. So you can see the power of doing this. It's enormous. But the question of how to do it is a little more complex. But we'll touch on that. William Davis, MD, a friend of mine, cardiologist in the States, has published one of the only human studies that looked at progression and stopping it. And he used a mild statin, he used omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils, he used vitamin D, he used low-carb diets and no-grain diets, taking out all grains and sugars. That was very important. So he did a multi-factor intervention. 45 people he tracked over 3 years. He only got 3 of the 45 to progress at the usual rapid rate. He got nearly half of them to have slow progression, which is fantastic, because that doesn't happen generally in normal medicine. And nearly half actually went backwards. They actually regressed, right? So in other words, 42 out of 45 with his intervention got themselves to safety. And he has told me, and many other cardiologists in my worldwide network, that people who follow their multi-factor intervention, they effectively eliminate repeat heart attacks and heart attacks in general. Right? Effectively eliminate them. They're totally preventative. So that is the way to go. And in the next 10 years, I think we'll see more of this coming out. Right now, this is not so well known at all. So I'm going to show you a little clip now, a little break with a little movie that we got made with a significant budget. It's releasing in a couple of months. And I'm just going to show you a little 2 minute of the trailer. So David has supported it, and we have Donal O'Neill, a friend of mine, a filmmaker who made it. But we actually got the 45 Mead and Down team from 1991, and they're in their late 50s now, mostly in pretty good shape, and we scanned them. We saw some amazing stuff, but this is the trailer.
In 1991, Down defeated Meath to win the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship.
The 104th All-Ireland Football Final is underway. Kane firing it forward towards James McCartan. Can he be a match winner yet? On to Ross Carr, a quick look up once more.
But here we are almost 30 years later, and we're going to find out not just who is the toughest anymore, but perhaps who's the most resilient and who's the healthiest.
Everyone always says, oh yeah, fit as a fiddle, super fit.
Rambo, fucking Rambo.
A bit of a shock result. He's come in over 1,200, Ivor.
Oh, 1,200, that's a big score.
No one has ever tested asymptomatic, healthy, retired elite sportsmen for heart disease.
They're firing well right now, Meath. Another scoring chance. Outside it comes to Bernard Flynn. Oh, it's stopped. Secure in his holding. It's touched down again to David Beggy. A real business-like approach now from Meath, frantically pouring everything they have into attack.
Of course, there's no ball this time, and the CT scanner is now the scoreboard. We will scan the players for heart disease, and the winning team will be the one with the lowest average calcium score.
If my arteries were that of an 86-year-old.
What the hell is going on here? Did I have advanced heart disease? Why are we not looking for that?
If we use this scan widely for middle-risk people and we identified the truly high-risk versus low-risk, we could treat the high-risk.
I think the evidence is overwhelming that coronary calcium scoring is the most predictive test for prognostic risk. So if you want to know what your risk is for heart disease, have a coronary calcium score.
So this will be out in probably a couple of months' time. We're doing a Kickstarter in the next month or so, and we're actually showing a premiere up in the Down main GAA on the 28th, but that's a private showing. So it's going to go through all of this, and it's very entertaining, and the guys were fantastic. But we scanned around 45, like I said, and they were all presumed to be completely healthy by their doctors themselves. And we got 9 people with super high scores, and they had to immediately go follow up a cardiologist. One has since had a multiple way bypass, and others have also had operations, but they're preventative. But they only found out because of the scan. So you can probably see David's passion now. Find them before they have the heart attack, not after. So demonstrating heart disease reversal, we happened to have 4 people over the couple of years when we were shooting the movie who had significant scores. And what should happen by orthodox medicine or the Heinz-Nixdorf recall study is they should just keep going up. Progressive disease, like type 2 diabetes, it's chronic, progressive, it'll keep getting worse. However, the 4 people we happened to have who took the multiple measures, one of them had the score the same, slightly lower, 2 years later. Another one similarly. Another one with a moderate score actually went backwards, okay? And another one with a very high score went backwards too. So 4 out of 4. And this was very informal and casual. So it'll show you the potential of what we can achieve if, like Dr. Davis, multi-factor interventions are done effectively on the people who are identified with major risk. Just to stress, I showed you this. If you slow or stop progression, you know, there's an enormous amount of risk reduction to play for. Huge. So then, what drives the progression? And we're going to get a little bit into a bit of controversial stuff here as we talk about what actually drives heart disease. So on the left, you see Western white men, and apologies to the graph, but it's just showing the amount of calcification up to the score of 4,800. And as the people get older in the West, this is white man Western from Mises study, you see that around 10 or 15 or 20% of them get enormous calcification, up to 5,000, right? And over 40% of heart attacks occur in the top 10% of calcifiers, which of course makes sense, right? So we are riddled in the West with calcification, which is the direct measure of cardiac disease. Samoan men, who are studied all the time, right, over in Bolivia, I think, same study, that's their calcification. Don't really have any, they don't have heart attacks. So how can this be? How come Catavans are the same? Completely genetic different people, the exact same, they've no calcification, no heart attacks. The Maasai, studies in 1972, cut open a load of hearts, no calcification, and they don't have heart attacks. They're wondering why. Because the Maasai warriors are eating mostly milk, meat, and blood. So they're kind of thinking, oh, they're going to be full of disease. No, nothing. Right? Why? The reason is they're missing the primary drivers of cardiac disease and many other modern chronic diseases. I'm not going to get into detail of all of them, but this list is fairly good. It's never going to be complete. But I will pull out hyperinsulin, high blood insulin levels and insulin resistance, and blood glucose abnormalities that go with that. Because this is the big guy in town. This is the biggest thing in heart disease, and it always was. Unidentified or undiagnosed type 2 diabetes, because type 2 diabetes is actually hyperinsulinemia. It's high insulin. Yeah, you get high blood glucose when you've had it for 20 years, but mostly it's really a disease of high blood insulin. So I'm going to give one piece of homework only, just one. When you go home, Google insulin resistance and put in the disease of your choice. You can put in the solid tumor cancers, endometrial, colon cancer. You can put in heart disease. You can even put in neurological problems. But you're going to find a massive pile of science. Because in the last 20 or 30 years, there's a dawning realization that insulin resistance sits at the very epicenter of modern chronic disease. And how many of you are familiar that cholesterol might be a risk for heart disease? Everyone. How many of people, or you people know that insulin resistance is vastly more important? Okay, we got a couple. We're getting there. You all happen to know me. Coincidence. Okay, so I give you a quick picture. We have masses of science on this, but just to show you here, heart attack risk ratio over 7 years in people who had a first heart attack. And they tracked these guys for 7 years and they measured all their bloods. And they wanted to find out what's the biggest thing that connects to having a second heart attack, right? These are really important because your second heart attack often takes you away. So we have high total cholesterol and high LDL bad cholesterol. And they measured those and tracked them. And if you're down here at one, it means you have one times the risk if you're high and one times the risk if you're low. In other words, the risk factor is useless. And what they found was the total or the bad cholesterol didn't predict anything, no statistical significance. And I have tons of studies. I'm just using this one for illustration. High blood pressure, though, was double the risk. Blood pressure is a very significant risk factor, and we even know the mechanisms now by which high blood pressure causes shear stress problem in the arteries and all that. But also, most idiopathic blood pressure, or blood pressure with no known cause, most of it is due to insulin resistance. So, and there's insulin, nearly a 7 times risk for having high blood insulin. But most studies over 50 years have not been looking too closely at this because the world of heart disease has been very focused on cholesterol. But that gives you an illustration of relative importance. Undiagnosed type 2 diabetics. That's what these guys are. And it's arguable that type 2 diabetes is called a previous heart attack equivalent. In other words, having type 2 diabetes is so high a risk, you're at the same risk as if you had a heart attack already. And the reason is that most heart attacks are driven by diabetic dysfunction. A little bit of my story, just to break things up a bit, and not too long. Back in 2013, I had three measures, including cholesterol, that were very high. Now, they should look like this. It was GGT, a liver enzyme, ferritin, you know. So that's what they should look like. That's what mine looked like for GGT. That's what my ferritin looked like. That's what my cholesterol looked like. So I spent 30 years working with problem solving. Oh yeah, I was going to skip it. Okay, gamma glutamyl transferase, it's a liver enzyme you get in your liver panel. And basically when it's high, your liver is screaming. We have a phrase in my business, the long silent scream of the liver, because unless you look at the GGT and you look at other measures, you won't see it, right? So fatty liver disease is now an epidemic in the Western world, not just in adults, but in America, fatty liver disease, non-alcoholic, is an epidemic in children. Didn't exist 60, 70, 80 years ago. So think about that. So anyway, I get these massive figures and I'm reading them kind of upside down, looking at them, and I don't really know what they mean, even though I did biochemical. I wasn't sure, but I realized I'm so far outside the distribution that this must be something important. It has to be. I just knew instinctively. So I quizzed the doctor pretty aggressively, probably more than anyone else would. But there wasn't really much clarity on A, how serious it was, and B, what the root causes were, because I'm a root cause guy. What are the root causes that drive these up that I can go and fix? That was my first instinct. Went to a second doctor to get more, family friend, didn't get a whole lot, and went to a very senior person, a little bit more, got some tests, some genetic tests for hemochromatosis. Anyway, nothing came out of it. And I was generally told to eat more whole grains, healthy whole grains, and less fat maybe, you know? That's no good. And what occurred to me after I went through this over a few weeks was huge. I thought, wow, if the experts in this stuff are not sure what to do to fix it, how can that be? There must be some enormous missing link that I can go and find out what it is. So when the experts don't know in my day job, I go and I research. And to give you an idea of ferritin, I have logons, corporate logons to all the research databases, all the published science for the last 100 years, human, animal, everything. But you can see there's over 10,000 publications on ferritin and disease. So I had plenty to go after. So I went after it all and I said, what do the markers mean? What are the pathogenesis of diseases from these markers? What's it mean? So here's me in Singapore. Just after I found out initially what was going on, I was pretty angry, and I realized I'm going to have to root cause this and fix this, because I found out very quickly that the risk related to these markers made cholesterol look like a good thing, the GGT and the ferritin. So I realized, oh my God, like there were someone that were 15 times the risk for future diabetes for high GGT at my weight. You know, I've seen shocking risk multipliers for these measures. So I hit the books hard for a while, and in the end I realized, okay, I've put it together. I know what GGT is doing, I know what ferritin's doing, I know where cholesterol sits, and I know what to do. So what I did was, I realized it was all nutritional, was the problem. This is what I was eating. I was drinking a ton of orange juice, didn't realize it was pure sugar straight to my liver, but anyway. Chocolate didn't bother me too much, so I was a bit high on the fructose sugar. I was good, decent meals and fat and protein generally, but we were using vegetable oils, seed oils, industrial extracted seed oils, and I didn't realize that was not good. And I was eating way too many healthy whole grains and carbohydrates, because I believed the pyramid, and I used to do triathlons. I ate a lot of the healthy so-called stuff. So I realized that the solution was to go to plenty of vegetables, lower carb, lower starchy carbohydrates, low carb diet with lots of healthy ancestral foods, many of which are kind of higher fat, but it doesn't matter if you're not eating this with it. And I cut out all this junk up here. Sugar is a massive problem, but I'm sure you know that. So I did that. I basically went with this kind of pyramid, which I pulled a couple of weeks ago just to illustrate. Vegetables, non-starchy, not full of glucose, you know, meats, fish, eggs, healthy stuff. Berry fruits are low sugar. You know, we don't want to be eating fruit every day. We used to only eat it in the autumn. But berry fruits are low sugar and they've got lots of nutrients. So more of those than the big sugary ones and so on. And I, of course, switch to olive oil, beef tallow and natural fats rather than the industrial vegetable oils. So what happened? The power of my new pyramid, which is kind of the upside down version of the one we've been told. What happened? Well, a problem solving engineer for 30 years, if they get this wrong, kind of an idiot. So hopefully something happened. So here's the GGT 112. It should not be over 40. It should not really be over 30 odd. That's essentially insulin resistance, GGT that high. That's the silent scream from your liver, okay? Did the pyramid? Only change I did. No exercise change, nothing else, just the food. 6 weeks, down to 42. Okay, I'll take it. I would have been happy with 60 because it was on a vector down, but 42 was great. 2 weeks later, I just wanted to double check, 35 and rolling down. And Dr. David Unwin in the UK now, he uses GGT to measure his patients' compliance to low carb. If they cheat with sugar and they go off the wagon, their GGT tells them immediately. It's a great measure. But that's not all that happened. My ferritin went down from very high levels to pretty much normal enough for a guy. My cholesterol, the total figures don't mean much, but the ratios when you divide them together actually are useful because they're a good indicator of insulin resistance. They got way better. Blood pressure came down from hypertensive to pretty damn good without changing anything but diet. And that dropped within 2 weeks before the weight even started coming off, because blood pressure is a sign of metabolic disease and things like insulin problems. It's not really the weight that causes it. The weight just tracks with it, okay? My weight came down, yeah, quite a lot, for sure, in 8 weeks. And my waist came down a lot in eight and a half weeks. So my wife was quite happy with this, actually, because it kind of looked a bit better. That's what happened. Now, when you do a single intervention, this is very important in engineering in a complex problem, you know it's a major root cause and hugely important if something specific happens. If the thing you're trying to fix gets better, that obviously it was an important cause. But if the whole system gets better in a multifaceted way and everything in the system dramatically gets better on your production line, you know you got a super important root cause and you know you got the tiger by the tail. That's what this nutritional intervention is. It's super important root cause. So the elephant in the room that I've touched on. 64% of US adults from the latest figures over 45s are now officially pre-diabetic or diabetic. Pre-diabetic, diabetic, insulin resistant, hyperinsulinemic, it's all the same. They've all got type 2 diabetes physiology. It's all the same. I don't use these categories. Myself and Dr. Gerber and myriad other doctors in our network would say it's 75% plus if you used insulin measurements. 75% of your population, right, have the dysfunction that overwhelmingly drives most heart attacks. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? 75%. Like, what have we been doing? So they're essentially diabetic. EuroAspire study is a sad validation of this. So in 2015, they went all across Europe because this team realized, oh my God, insulin glucose diabetes is much bigger than we think, and it's huge in heart disease, and we better start going looking a little closer. So what they did was they surveyed all coronary disease victims, or a huge sample. Patients age 18 to 80, we want all ages from the early guys up to the old guys. 24 European countries, because we want to represent the whole of Europe. This is really great, this is an amazing study. And what they found out was, well, straight away they found out that a third were already diagnosed type 2 diabetics. A third of them? Ooh, wow, okay. But they looked closely at their glucose metrics and they found out another ton of them were full-blown type 2 diabetics, which means you've had it 20 years. Another huge chunk they said were high risk for diabetes because they didn't technically meet the criteria. They're type 2 diabetic, no question. So 75% or more of heart disease victims are type 2 diabetic. And the remainder, they didn't actually use insulin. and you must use insulin blood tests to diagnose type 2 diabetes at the earliest stages. So we reckon a good chunk of them in here are too. So you wanna wonder what's the big thing in heart disease? The drivers I told you: hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, blood glucose dysregulation is the big one. Undiagnosed type 2 diabetes is enormous. And all my colleagues in cardiology now around the world are acknowledging this. TOFIs, did you ever hear of what TOFIs are? Thin outside, fat inside? Something everyone should know about. So if a non-obese non-smoker in their 50s suddenly has a heart attack, chances are they're a TOFI. They don't appear fat, they're not obese, but they're fat inside, right? Basically, here's an example, 22 BMI, not fat at all, 6 footer, right? Looks great. It's full of fat in his organs, right? All the visceral fat is inside in the organs. You only see it with a CT scan. No one's looking, like calcification. This is where a ton of heart attacks come from in people who don't appear fat, they don't smoke, and they're like David Bobbitt. They basically got diabetic dysfunction inside, but no one's looking, because you won't see it in your blood glucose. Not until it's really late, okay? 40% of non-obese in US now, figures from Professor Lustig, are TOFI. Their risk is right up there with obese people. So we all look at the obese people and we say, oh, heart attack waiting to happen. Well, a major chunk of non-obese people who look reasonably grand, they're just as much risk because they have the metabolic disease that's progressing, atherosclerosis. Same thing, guys. This is the big one. There's lots of other causes, don't get me wrong. I'm not ruling out. There's genetic quirks, there's heavy metal contamination. Even lead now is acknowledged. Lead and petrol is acknowledged to have caused hundreds of thousands of heart attacks over the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's why they took it away. So there's loads of other kind of causes, but I just want to focus on the big one. Undiagnosed. So how do we fix the elephant, right? Because an engineer, and this is just screaming at us, right? We've got an elephant here, the biggest cause, the monster cause. We're not addressing it. Wow, let's get on it, let's fix this stuff. You saw that I did it, right? Fair enough, but I'm one person. But we look a bit at dietary drivers. What are the dietary things that would be the worst things to tend to put you in this place? And here I put a simple diagram on the left. This is what I would call ultra-processed food, and this is the bad stuff. Generally, that's a simple way. Breads are all highly refined grains. They're all glucose sugar, essentially. Pasta's the same. They don't even have a high amount of egg or protein anymore. They're junk food. Cereal bars, cereals, all glucose. They're all just essentially sugar, right? There's bugger all fat or protein, they're essentially sugar. The modern industrial seed oils, there's a huge amount of fuss building over. They call them vegetable oils, but they're extracted from seeds with hexane and high temperatures and pressures, deodorization steps. A lot of molecular question marks in there. So I would never, ever allow those in the house. But essentially, the seed oils, the refined grains and the sugars are what makes up most modern ultra-processed food. And in the UK, over 50% of calories now eaten by people is acknowledged to come from ultra-processed foods. And there are papers being written, right? But this started in the 1900s with the original hydrogenated vegetable fats that came in the 1920s and the sugars and the refining of grains. So it started a long time ago, but it's really bad now. So you dodge that and you dodge processed foods, packet foods, you're well on your way. You've got to eat some food, so I'd say real ancestral foods, evolutionary foods. Some of them will be higher fat. That's okay. Once you don't eat refined grains and sugars, the fat's fine. If you start mixing them together, you're in a gray area. But all these things, butter now, you know, Time magazine 2 years ago came out, butter, we were all wrong. You know, it's changing. Things are changing. Vegetables, great. Fish, of course. Again, lower sugar fruits, ideally. High-fat avocados, high-fat olives. Gee, organ meats are superfoods. You want to ask me about a superfood? I'll tell you an egg. An egg is a superfood. A pastured egg. Organ meats, liver, kidneys, they're superfoods. Massively nutrient-dense. To my kale and leaves, these are superfoods, you know? So that's the way you would tilt your diet. real ancestral, real foods. Exercise is important too. It helps with insulin resistance. Potassium, magnesium, particularly magnesium, are very important for arterial health and general health. And a lot of people are deficient now. They reckon maybe 70 or 80% of people in the modern world are magnesium deficient. It's unclear how much, but it's bad. And of course, things like people are not eating fish anymore, and omega-3, DHA, EPA. It's good to get a lot of good, healthy, fatty fish or, I guess, supplement. But I'm just giving you a flavor. I don't want to go down a rabbit hole on diet. Real foods, not fake foods, is the way to go. So, undiagnosed type 2 diabetes, just a couple of studies. If this is our main problem, undiagnosed diabetes, let's look at what happens when you do what I say with diabetes. So Virta have just come out with a human trial of 1 year, around 450 people, and all they gave them was a low-carb, keto, very low-carb diet. No calorie restriction, just an app to help them stick to the diet and the diet. They got 94% of them off or decreased their medications. 60% became technically non-diabetic in the year. Their blood glucose level had gone below the diabetic range, and they got weight loss, and their blood sugars got fantastic, relatively. That was just the diet I'm talking about alone for a year. And type 2 diabetes is called a chronic progressive disease, and it will increase and get worse until you need more meds. That is an absolute fact in the medical world. It has been stated. Virta just went in and got 60% of them to drop off the diabetes register with a diet alone. They're addressing the root cause. That's why. Here's a study, recent 2019, military personnel, a bit overweight, gave half the people a keto, really low carb diet, the other half their standard chow. And the people who got the keto diet, they went down 18 pounds, and I think it was only 3 or 4 months. Body fat 5% down, visceral fat, the fat I told you about in the organs, it went down by nearly half, right, just with diet. And their insulin resistance metrics went down around 30% in just a few months, just with diet. That's attacking root cause. And the last one is a case history here, but there's so many of these coming out now, I'm just showing you a few, but this guy I thought was interesting. Insulin resistant dyslipidemia, that means bad cholesterol ratios. Went in again 3 months, he had brain fog and he was beginning to fail those cognitive kind of strength tests. Diet alone, keto diet, 90% reduction in his HOMA insulin resistance and his fasting blood insulin. 90% in a few months. 30% down in his A1C, a blood glucose measure. He was diabetic. Not when he went down 30%. He now is technically non-diabetic. Now, if he starts eating grains and sugars and that stuff again, he'd be diabetic in no time. Don't get me wrong. But he's technically non-diabetic after a few months, once he keeps this up. And his MoCA cognitive score went up 26% and went into the normal range. Can you imagine that? Just with diet. It's all published. Mountains of this out there. But that's attacking the root cause. So it's a big deal. Wisdom from a century ago, my last slide. Isn't it ironic that what we're discovering now and I'm describing to you is all new science, apparently? No. Rebecca Oppenheimer wrote a diet book for people with diabetic issues over 100 years ago. Foods strictly forbidden for anyone with any diabetic problem. Flour, bread, biscuits, all farinaceous foods and starches, all sugars. Strictly forbidden for people with a diabetic challenge, which 75% of America have now, and to be honest, I don't know where Ireland is. And the foods, owing to their great nutritive qualities, are especially valuable. Well, I agree, Rebecca. Bacon, ham, pork, tongue, beef, mutton, goose, duck, butter, olive oil, cream, caviar, eggs, mackerel, salmon. Real food, not refined grains. So that'll give you an overview just of what way you go to get away from the fake foods. And I leave just the last couple of words to David, just the closing clip from our movie.
I am David Bobbitt, and I know my score.
And that's really what the talk is about, knowing your score, knowing your risk, and taking action, right? So I think now we can move to Q&A, and I'm sure there'll be a few questions.